In understanding German Hasidism as the anticipation of the later developments in Jewish mysticism, we could see how from German Hasidic interest in finding the spirit within all things, and in its notion of a gradation within God, an anticipation of what the theosophic theurgic Kabbalah would do with great elaboration in developing its notions of the depths of God's spherotic life. The other thing that we saw in German Hasidism was a set of techniques by which the texts of the Bible or the physical universe could be reduced into their spiritual unity and thereby gain an image or a vision of the unified presence of God within all things. When Abraham Abu Afia took those techniques and applied them to himself, he became an introverted mystic. Altogether, the anticipations of the Kabbalah in both its prophetic, ecstatic, Abulafian tendency and the anticipations of theurgic, theosophic Kabbalah in German Hasidism, we find altogether three ways in which medieval Jews restructured their perception of the outside world. The outside world, in a sense, was left intact. All that changed was the inner point of view, their point of mind. And to quote a mystic from another tradition, from the Eastern Byzantine tradition, there's a statement that goes as follows. Since you cannot change the world which you see with your eyes, then change the eyes with which you see the world. And that's precisely what the German Hasidim did, and what Abraham Abulafia and his disciples did, and what the theosophic, theurgic Kabbalah did. It changed the eyes with which the world was seen, and new worlds appeared, either the worlds within Abulafian consciousness, or the worlds within God's own being, and the universe and the soul, according to the Zohar and its antecedents in the Bahir. There was no political activity to change things. It was all internal. It's as if the Jews had gone to a psychotherapist who, in her wisdom, would have said, you can't beat City Hall. You can't change the past. Reality is reality. It's a matter of changing your mind about what all of those things mean in order to be liberated from the paralyzing pain that you feel from your understanding of reality. You can't change the world, but you can change the way you see it. Profoundly, you can't change yourself, the psychotherapist would say, but profoundly, you could change your attitudes and your understanding of what the world is and who you are. If you cannot change the world that you see with your eyes, say all of these, then change the eyes with which you see the world. And that's the key to understanding the various versions of Jewish mysticism that we've been examining. But as Jewish history proceeded down through the Middle Ages, it became less and less possible to luxuriate in the passivity, in the modest quietism, which said the world can't be changed and we ought to be satisfied with changing the eyes with which we see. It became harder and harder to do as medieval Jewish life unfolded. In its early centuries, medieval Jewish life, be it in the Islamic world or in Christian Europe, was a fairly open, flourishing, friendly, interactive pioneer land in which the Jews participated in the building up of new cultures on the soil of the ancient ones. From roughly the 7th century to the 12th century, relations between the Jews and the outside world were more or less cordial. There were interruptions, there were idiosyncratic outbreaks of hostility, or for to use the word anti-Semitism in its generic sense of hostility toward the Jew. But in the early centuries of the Middle Ages, the Jews flourished and lived in cordial, friendly relations with their neighbors. For reasons which scholars are debating even today, there was a profound transformation in European civilization somewhere in the 11th, 12th, 13th century, people argue exactly when it all began, but there was a dramatic shift in a different direction, away from cordiality, away from interactive neighborliness, away from cooperation. Europe became, as one historian put it, a persecuting society. Some Jewish historians say that the turning point was at the First Crusade in 1096. Others say that that was only an anticipation of what would later come to be the end of the 12th century and the 13th, when Europe was no longer cordial to the others, to the sick, to the Jew, to the deviants, to the people who didn't seem to belong, to the emergent homogeneity of what we today recognize as the modern bureaucratic nation state. Somewhere in the 12th and in the 13th century, Europe became a persecuting society and turned its anger and its hostility and its fear and its hatred toward the Jew, and began to express that hatred and antagonism in actual social political events. Jewish property was expropriated, loans made by Jews to non-Jews were canceled, Jews were expelled from one land after another beginning in the 12th century, 13th, 14th. They were libeled with all sorts of superstitious things, charging the Jews with poisoning the very physical welfare of European society. Europe became a persecuting society, and the Jews increasingly became an alienated minority. From the very beginning, the Jews were aware that they were living in exile. There was a sense that this was not their homeland, no matter how long they had been there, no matter how cordial the relations. Their prayers, composed by the rabbis in the Greco-Roman period, again and again emphasized for them that their true homeland was the land of Israel, and that where they were then was galut, exile, alien, away from home, living precariously, where they truly didn't belong. But these were merely matters of repetition of prayers. There was a deep sense of alienation, but day-to-day life didn't always conform to the sense that this was diaspora, exile. But as Europe became more and more the persecuting society, the more and more external realities began to conform to the sense that this was galut, it was exile, that Jewish life was precarious. Jewish life couldn't survive where it was. Expulsion, expropriation, pogrom, blood libels, one sad tale after another of the persecution of the other who was the Jew. In 1391, in the center of one of the oldest and most glorious and well-established Jewish communities in Spain, Spain, led, prompted by some churchmen and by some of the aristocracy and some of the other population, decided that Jews were not really allowed to be in Spain anymore, that they were a threat to Christianity, and that they were a threat to Spanish society. And there was an explosion of violence against the Jews in Spain that lasted from about 1391 to 1412. Jews were forced to convert to Christianity. They were forced to sit in churches and listen to sermons preached at them in order to get them to convert. There was bloodshed. There was riots. Many Jews, in order to save themselves, converted, and when things quieted down, they reverted to Judaism when it was safe to do. Spain settled down after the mania between 1391 and 1412, having for a while created a nightmare of life for Jews where they were no longer safe physically, some Jews actually becoming Christians and reverting when it was possible. Things quieted down for about 40 or 50 years. But as the 15th century reached its close, when the kingdoms of Aragon and Castile were united into a single Spain with the marriage of Ferdinand and Isabella, with a strong centralized government, without different provinces being able to govern their own affairs, with the desire to create a national identity, Spanish society decided that it needed to be homogeneous, and it needed to rid itself of its two alien groups, the two alien groups being the Muslims, who had been there since the 7th century, and who had controlled much of Spain after its conquest until the end of the 15th century, and of course, the Jews as well. It's well known, in 1492, an edict of expulsion was issued, in which it was no longer permitted for Jews to remain in Spain. If a Jew wanted to remain, for whatever reason, business, family, comfort, out of conviction that Christianity was the true religion, perhaps disheartened by centuries of persecution and become Christian, they were allowed to stay. But unless they were going to convert, the Jews in Spain needed to leave. They were expelled. In August of 1492, it was no longer legal for a Jew to be in Spain. The majority of the population of Spain, suffering the turmoil and the catastrophe and the dislocation of exile, made their way in a variety of directions. Most of them would go immediately south to North Africa, across the Straits of Gibraltar, the Islamic lands of North Africa, the Maghreb, where there had long been Jewish communities, and where there were people and family to receive the refugees. Most Jews couldn't go north into France because that too was a Catholic country, and it more or less honored the edict of expulsion issued by the Catholic royalty of Ferdinand and Isabella. The bulk of the Jews then left Spain, making their way as refugees to North Africa. Other Jews undertook the more dangerous voyage into the Greek islands, some of them stopping on their way to Italy. But many, many Jews slowly but surely made their way further east, where they were welcomed and invited to settle without threat to their life by the Ottoman Empire. And so the Jews from Spain, the Sephardic Jews of Spanish origin, made their way from North Africa through Italy to the Greek islands, to the Balkans, and to the Ottoman Empire in the Middle East, returning to their place of origin. Some of the Jews were even allowed to settle in one of the territories controlled by the Ottoman Empire, the land of Israel itself, home, the place where redemption would begin, the place where redemption would culminate. Many, many Jews made their way, Spanish-speaking Jews, made their way to the Ottoman Empire. Many stayed in North Africa. Some made their way increasingly deeper and deeper and deeper into the Middle East, bringing them with them the sense of fracture, catastrophe, dislocation, the loss of the familiar, the life of a wandering refugee, and the suffering that comes from relocating and leaving your homeland. That's group number one after 1492. The thousands, tens upon thousands, hundred thousands of Jews who made their way to different places in North Africa and the Ottoman Empire. Of the Jews who remained in Spain, they could only have done so if they converted. And many, many did. Some, hoping to escape, made their way across into Portugal. But that was jumping from the frying pan into the fire, because in 1496, 97, by edict, all people living in Portugal, Jews in particular, were automatically considered Christian. Once someone became a Christian, then someone became subject to Christian courts. Up until the 12th or 13th century, Judaism had been illicit religion. There had been nothing wrong with it. And as long as a Jew was a Jew, there were no crimes being committed, unless, of course, they didn't want Jews anymore. But once the Jews in Spain and Portugal had been converted either by force or by choice to Christianity, they fell subject to the courts controlling good Christian behavior, the Inquisition. the beginning, things were more or less okay. The new Christians, as they were called, the conversos, the Jews who had converted, found their way into Spanish society and retained the positions of wealth, authority, prestige, and business connections which they had enjoyed before. But it didn't take long for Spain to turn sour on its new converts, on the newly won Christians. They began being called Meranos, in Spanish a pejorative term, pig. People who really can't be trusted. The suspicion was that these Jews who had converted had not converted for proper reasons, and that they were secretly harboring Jewish belief, and that in secret they were actually practicing Jewish rituals. In a sense, Spain went paranoid. It suspected all of these Jews of not being good Christians, because actually they weren't Jews anymore, they were new Christians, and their Christianity was called into question. The Inquisition persecuted them, hounded them. To be found guilty of practicing secret Judaism or harboring Jewish identity was a heresy against the church. To save these people from their sins, they would need to be tortured, imprisoned until they confessed. Being confessed, they could then be redeemed, but not until their properties had been destroyed, and in many cases, their bodies burned. For after all, it wasn't the body that really was important, it was the soul. Spain became racist. Spain said that no matter what people behave, what patterns of behavior people follow, even if they went to church, if in all ways they resembled Christians, there was still something about a Jewish blood that rendered the Jew suspect. The more the Jews became like the Spaniards, the more they were suspected of being wrong, corrupt, degenerate. And the Inquisition tracked these people down with a vengeance. Seeking to escape the Gestapo-like techniques of the Inquisition, Jews would manage to smuggle themselves out or under subterfuge get out of Spain and go to a place where they would be received to undo the harm of living under persecution. The Christians who were once upon a time Jews or the descendants of Jews throughout the 16th century made their way to the safe havens of North Africa, Italy, and the Ottoman Empire. And once the Reformation had been underway, parts of Northern Europe that had become Protestant, places like Amsterdam, were open welcome doors to the Jews from Spain who wanted to escape the paranoia and the persecution of the Inquisition. Other Jews made their way to the New World, to the Spanish and Portuguese colonies in South America and in North America, bearing with them the catastrophic consequences of having lived under the fear of the Inquisition, living perhaps, even if they didn't want to, with a sense of a division between their outer life, their appearance, and their inner sense of identity. Even if they weren't in all ways good Christians, the way they were looked upon by their neighbors caused them to feel that inside they were different. The disparity between inner life and inner identity and external behavior, on top of the trauma of having lived through these catastrophic events of 1492 and after, left their impress on the Jewish soul. It left their impress on the Jews who left in 1492 and who had to make their own way and who had to cope with the problem of the conversos who returned to them becoming Jews after having lived as Christians. Dislocation, exile, fracture, paranoia, division between inner and outer, exile, wandering. Nothing seemed to be in its place. Nothing seemed to be where it belonged. But hand in hand with all of this catastrophic trauma of 1492, the capstone of some 250, 300 years of Europe's persecuting society, hand in hand with the catastrophe of exile and dislocation, came the sense of redemption and new birth. For many of these Jews did return to the land of Israel, many of them settling in the Galilee in a little village called Sfat, Safed, not far from Lake Tiberias. And in this 16th century Jewish community of Safed, living on the soil of the land of Israel, the place of redemption, Jewish life was reconceived, reconfigured, and rededicated with a new spirit of renewal, pulsing with the need for messianic redemption. It had gone too far. 1492 was the stroke that indeed broke the camel's back. But with the breaking of the back came the renewal of Tzfat. New ideas, new law books written, new prayers composed, and from Tzfat, Safed in Israel, there went out new ideas to the Jewish world, responding to the profound catastrophic trauma of exile, expulsion, and of living schizophrenic lives split between outer realities and internal. It was in Sfat in the 16th century that the Kabbalah, which until that time had remained a relatively quiet, closely held corporation, handed down from master to disciple. Many books had been written, but how many read them? Some of the books that were written, like Nachmanides' commentary, merely offered secrets, allusions. The ideas were not all that well known. It was private, esoteric. But in 15th century, in 16th century Tzfat, the Kabbalah underwent a transformation in at least two senses. One, it was no longer private. It was no longer esoteric. It was now aggressively promulgated wherever there were Jews, in North Africa, in the Ottoman Empire, in Italy, even making its way to the other major center of Jewish life in the 16th century, Eastern Europe, the Jews of Poland, who from the 13th and 14th centuries had migrated from Germany east to Poland, where they had been welcomed. Wherever there were Jews, the new ideas, prayers, laws, codifications of Jewish practice reached them, transforming Jewish life with the spirit of redemption and the need for messianic healing after the ruptures of the last 250 years. In thinking back on why things had gone wrong, rather than on blaming the world, as the Jews began to diagnose why things had gone so sour, why 1492, who was to blame, many of them pointed the fingers at philosophy. Philosophy was said to have undermined Jewish identity, robbed the Jews of their sensitivity to spiritual realities, opened the doors of Gentile society, and gave the Jews the illusion that truth was to be found outside of the revealed traditions of the Jewish learning. Philosophy was blamed as one of the major sins for what had happened to the Jews. Philosophy, which had fought with mysticism until 1492 for the hearts and minds of the Jewish intelligentsia, lost the battle to the mystics, to the ones who were able to understand what had happened, who were more aggressive in blaming philosophy, and who had developed a system of understanding the significance of religious behavior, linking their mystical ideas to everyday Jewish practice in a way which the philosophers apparently had never been able to do. The philosophers were much too anthropocentric, much too concerned with just the human being, the individual, and they apparently had ignored God's needs and the collective needs of the Jewish people. Philosophy never had a chance. From 1391 to 1492, as the Jews were suffering the pangs of Spanish maltreatment, Jewish philosophy was subjected to one line of criticism after another, many of the critics being inspired directly by Kabbalistic ideas, if they weren't Kabbalists themselves, or moderate theologians who had been inspired and influenced by Kabbalistic notions of God's inner being and the significance of human deeds. The mystics were the ones who were able to say to the Jews, we know why things have gone wrong, and we know what we can do to fix it. That, after all, was the principle of theurgy. The mystics were also able to make sense of the catastrophic events of the 14th, 15th, and 16th century by telling the people and making it clear to them that what had gone wrong was not just an earthly, ordinary thing, but if things had gone wrong here, they were merely an index to things that had gone wrong as well within the divine realm. The powers of evil, what the Kabbalists called the Sitra Achra, the other side, the shadowy side of reality, had burst forth from its rightful place. It had taken more than its due. It had darkened the lights of the Sfirot. It had caused catastrophe. Not only were the Jews suffering dislocation, fracture, and exile, not only was the temple in Jerusalem destroyed stone from stone, but according to the theosophical ideas of the Kabbalah, God too was in a state of inner exile. Or phrased in the Kabbalistic notions, the metaphors, the poetic metaphors of the union of God's feminine with his masculine, the rupture in history was a reflection of a rupture and a divorce and an alienation within God. The Holy One, blessed be he, the prince, was no longer together with the princess, with his queen. The Shekhinah, like the people of Israel, was in exile, suffering, fracture, and alienation. In Sfat, in the 16th century, the pietists and the scholars who had gathered there, filled with messianic fervor, inspired by the good news of resettling in Sfat, facing the catastrophes, reconfigured Judaism, absorbing into the Jewish mystical tradition all of the messianic yearning of the people that had suffered so much. One didn't need to be a Kabbalist to know that the time for redemption had come. One didn't need to be a Kabbalist in order to say that it was no longer enough to change the eyes with which one sees the world, since the world couldn't be changed. One didn't have to be a Kabbalist to begin feeling that the world itself needed change. And in Jewish consciousness, the change in the world would have to be brought by the Messiah, who would usher in the Messianic era. The Jews had been waiting a long time for their hoped Messiah, the one who would redeem them, gather them from their exile, bring them back to their home, restore everything as it was in the beginning. They had waited, and they had waited, and they had waited. They forgot the Messiah and his hopes as their internal spiritual discoveries and processes preoccupied their mind. But after 1492, it was less possible to remain satisfied with merely getting insight into the spiritual depths of the universe. It wasn't merely enough to transform human consciousness with Abulafian introverted techniques. It was no longer enough merely to read the Zohar as a guide to understanding the mysteries of God's life narrated on the pages of the Bible. Change in the world was necessary. The Messiah that people were waiting for just had to come. One didn't have to be a mystic to understand the hymn composed in the 16th century in Sfat by a great poet and a mystic himself, Solomon Alkabetz, who composed a special hymn for the Sabbath, which was written in the 16th century by the circle of people and saints and scholars living there. It's a hymn said even to this day in all synagogues, liberal, reform, traditional, orthodox, Hasidic. The service is called Welcoming the Sabbath, Kabbalat Shabbat. It begins with six psalms selected from the Bible, one psalm for each day of the week. Again, the Kabbalistic desire for correspondence, parallels, 6 days of the working week, one psalm for each of those days. The seventh hymn, however, was not taken directly from the book of Psalms, but it was a hymn that Solomon Alkabetz composed by taking messianic verses from the books of Isaiah and other biblical passages and weaving them into a beautiful hymn welcoming the Sabbath, whose metaphor was the bride, the queen. Lecha dodi likrat kala, pene shabbat nekabala. Come, my friend, let us meet the bride, let us welcome the Sabbath. The hymn that said, late Friday afternoon, before sunset, as the Sabbath is ushered in. A Sabbath hymn we would expect to deal with the theme of the Sabbath. And so the hymn begins, the first chorus. Observe and remember, the two first words of the Ten Commandments dealing with the Sabbath day. Observe the Sabbath day and remember the Sabbath day. In the hymn, the two commandments regarding the Sabbath were given as a single command. God spoke them both simultaneously. Some people hearing the word observe, other people hearing the word remember, was an old rabbinic interpretation. Observe and remember, God had pronounced polyphonously, the one God announced to us. The Lord is one, and his name is one, for fame, for glory, and for praise. One needn't be a Kabbalist to understand what all of these words meant. A reference to the biblical commandment about the Sabbath and the praise of God's unity. The second verse, too, on the theme of the Sabbath. Come, let us go to meet the Sabbath, for it is a source of blessing. From the very beginning it was ordained, last in creation, first in God's plan. But the third verse of the Sabbath hymn takes a surprising turn. It's not about God, and it's not about the Sabbath. It's about the temple in Jerusalem. Shrine of the King, Mikdash Melech, royal city, arise. Come forth from your ruins. Long enough have you dwelt in the vale of tears. God will show you abundant mercy. The fourth verse, not about the Sabbath, not necessarily about God, and this time not about the temple in Jerusalem, but the people who are told in the hymn, shake off your dust, arise, put on your glorious garments, my people, and pray, be near to my soul, and redeem it through the son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, a Jewish circumlocution for the Messiah. The Sabbath was now supercharged with messianic expectation and hope. The Messiah would redeem the people as a whole. They would leave the valley of tears. They would be dressed again in their glory. Their soul would be redeemed, as would the city of Jerusalem with them. The next verse, again messianic. Bestir yourself, for your light has come. And given the ambiguity of all religious poetry, as poetry in general, we're not sure what he's referring to when he says, for your light has come. Whose light is being referred to? The Sabbath's light? God's light? The city of Jerusalem's light? The temple's light? The people's light? The soul's light? Perhaps the answer is all of the above. One wouldn't need to be a Kabbalist to say all of the above. Bestir yourself, for your light has come. Arise and shine. Awake, awake, utter a song. The Lord's glory is revealed upon you. Be not ashamed nor confounded. Why are you downcast? Why do you moan? The afflicted of my people shall be sheltered within you. The city will be rebuilt on its ancient site. The Sabbath has long gone disappeared from consciousness. The theme of this hymn is messianic redemption. Messianic redemption for the city, for the people, for the soul, for the Sabbath itself. Those who despoiled you shall be themselves despoiled, whether that be the city of Jerusalem or the people of Israel. All who would devour you shall be far away. Your God will rejoice over you as a bridegroom rejoices over his bride. Bridegroom, bride, ancient metaphors, and one wouldn't have to be a Kabbalist to understand that this would be a reenactment of the old Song of Songs, which had taught that God to the people of Israel is as a groom to his bride. You shall extend to the right and to the left, the hymn continues, and you shall revere the Lord. Through an advent of the descendant of Peretz, we will rejoice and exult. Another reference, a direct reference to the Messiah. And then the refrain, come, my friend, to meet the bride. Let us welcome the Sabbath. Finally, the last verse. Come in peace, crown of God. Come with joy and cheerfulness. Amidst the faithful of your chosen people, come. O bride, come. O bride. And here the hymn begins to show its deep complexity. The Sabbath is now the bride rejoining its couple, the people of Israel, just as the people are the bride rejoining its groom, God. One wouldn't have to be a Kabbalist to understand the messianic pathos behind this hymn. But if one were a Kabbalist, one would understand that this prayer, made up of biblical verses, refers not only to ordinary things, to the historical people of Israel, to the historical figure of the Messiah, to the historical era of the reunification of the Jewish people with its own homeland, not only about the city of Jerusalem and the physical building called the Temple, not only about the Sabbath, not only about things down here, but the hymn as the Bible itself, as Nachmanides put it, would be speaking about earthly things, but alluding to divine things, to supernal secrets. For all of the words of this hymn, like all of the words of the Bible, are also understood to be the symbolic names of God, description of God's inner state of being, the fracture, the disunion between God the bride and God the groom, two of the ten spherot, the masculine and feminine within God. The messianic redemption will fix not only the broken people, will return not only the stones of the temple to their rightful place, but the messianic era will also see the light of the spherot rekindled, the channels reconnected, flowing into the sea. The prince and the princess, the bride of the Sefer Bahir, God with himself, will be reunited, and joy will reign, not only in this universe, but throughout the divine. To this day, people who are anti-mystical say this hymn without understanding that they're doing mysticism without realizing it. The hymn works at least four different levels of meaning, four, perhaps more, infinite. It certainly is a hymn, a messianic hymn, expressing the Jewish sentiment in the 16th century that was hoping for redemption, reunion, a healing of the ruptures, of the alienation. But to the Kabbalist, this hymn was also, and perhaps most importantly, describing what would happen within the divine realm in the messianic era. God's unity would be restored. Those who despoiled God would themselves be despoiled. The evil forces of evil that had surrounded the feminine within God and carried her off into exile as serpents twined around a maiden, as dragons dragging off the maiden to a cave somewhere, those forces of evil would be undone. God himself would no longer be sad or downcast, no longer moan. The afflicted of his own people will be sheltered within himself. The city, that secret name of one aspect of God's personality, will be rebuilt on its ancient site. And here the passage from the Zohar of God's beauty being restored to its fullness, being rebuilt, resonates in this hymn. God will be rebuilt, not just the people, not just the land, not just the temple. The Jews will unify with the Sabbath in their observance, and by doing so, they will cause a reunification of the divine lights, and a reunification of the divine lights with the life down here. The poem had deep Kabbalistic overtones for those who knew how to read them, but one didn't have to be a mystic to understand the messianic pathos of the Jewish community in Sfat in the 16th century. The Kabbalists absorbed messianic hope. They were the ones who would have to delve deeply in order to understand the catastrophe of 1492. They would be the ones who would draw the profound conclusion that the dislocation, fragmentation, suffering, and exile of the Jewish people on earth was merely the lowest, the last, and not necessarily the most horrific rupture in the very basis and structure of reality. They would be the ones who would say that the key to understanding God now would be the metaphor of exile. It was an old idea in the Kabbalah, but the old idea, the old notion of God being in exile took on greater poignancy and greater meaning after the events of 1492, after exile, after being a refugee. As the soul wandered from body to body in transmigration, as the Jewish people wandered the face of the earth, so too did God's spirit wander from its own self. And it would be the Kabbalists in 16th century who would diagnose the exile of God and who would give the treatment for fixing the exile within God and thereby fixing the exile on earth. The chief architect of this new, renewed, reconfigured, recharged, deeply poignant reworking of the Kabbalistic theosophy was Rabbi Isaac Luria, one of the luminaries of that 16th century community in Sfat. According to Luria's mythological understanding of why things have gone so wrong, there must have been a primal catastrophe within the divine itself, and what we're experiencing down on earth is merely the last unfolding of the catastrophe. From the old Kabbalah, Luria and his disciples would take hope in all of this dark news. God might be shattered. The Holy One, blessed be He, may be separated from the bride, but through proper action, they can be reunified. And in the reunification of the Holy One, blessed be He, with the feminine within God, all would reign well, peace. Or as the hymn said, come in peace, crown of God. Come with joy and cheerfulness amidst the faithful of the chosen people. Come, O bride, come, O bride. This was a hymn of God speaking to Himself, that part of God yearning for redemption. Come, my bride, come back to me as I come to you. Luria would be the one who would develop these ideas and elaborate this myth. He would be the one who would recast the old notions in the light of the terrifying experiences of the Jews from 1492 and on. He would give new life to the Kabbalists. He would speak to the Jews who weren't mystics, who were yearning for messianic redemption. He would speak to the Jews who had lived under the persecuting fear of the Inquisition, of the Jews who were burdened with the guilt of having been Christians and reverted, of Jews who had converted, thought they were good, but turned out not to have been so good. It would be Isaac Luria who would make all of this clear, and it would be his disciples who would spread the word to wherever the Jewish people were, unifying them in one grand army, fighting for messianic reunification, saving themselves, the earth, and God in the process. Thank you.